Harry in the country was different from Harry sitting on the back steps reading the newspapers and thinking about Hitler. They left early in the morning. The wheels he borrowed were the kind for boys with a bar between the legs. They strapped the lunches and bathing suits to the fenders and were gone before 9 o'clock. The morning was hot and sunny. Within an hour, they were far out of town on a red clay road. The fields were bright and green, and the sharp smell of pine trees was in the air. Harry talked in a very excited way. The warm wind blew into their faces. Her mouth was very dry, and she was hungry. "See that house up on the hill there? Let's us stop and get some water."
"No, we better wait. Well water gives you typhoid."
"I already had typhoid. I had pneumonia and a broken leg and an infected foot."
"I remember."
"Yeah," Mick said. "Me and Bill stayed in the front room when we had typhoid fever, and Pete Wells would run past on the sidewalk, holding his nose and looking up at the window. Bill was very embarrassed. All my hair came out, so I was bald-headed."
"I bet we're at least 10 miles from town now. We've been riding an hour and a half. Fast riding, too."
"I sure am thirsty," Mick said, "and hungry. What you got in that sack for lunch?"
"Cold liver pudding and chicken salad sandwiches and pie."
"That's a good picnic dinner."
She was ashamed of what she had brought.
"I got 2 hard-boiled eggs, already stuffed, with separate little packages of salt and pepper, and sandwiches, blackberry jelly with butter, everything wrapped in oil paper, and paper napkins."
"I didn't intend for you to bring anything," Harry said. "My mother fixed lunch for both of us. I asked you out here and all. We'll come to a store soon and get cold drinks." They rode half an hour longer before they finally came to the filling station store. Harry propped up the bicycles, and she went in ahead of him. After the bright glare, the store seemed dark. The shelves were stacked with slabs of white meat, cans of oil, and sacks of meal. Flies buzzed over a big, sticky jar of loose candy on the counter.
"What kind of drinks you got?" Harry asked.
The store man started to name them over. Mick opened the icebox and looked inside. Her hands felt good in the cold water.
"I want a chocolate knee-high. You got any of them?"
"Ditto," Harry said. "Make it 2.
"No, wait a minute. Here's some ice-cold beer. I want a bottle of beer, if you can treat as high as that."
Harry ordered one for himself also. He thought it was a sin for anybody under 20 to drink beer, but maybe he just suddenly wanted to be a sport. After the first swallow, he made a bitter face. They sat on the steps in front of the store. Mick's legs were so tired that the muscles in them jumped. She wiped the neck of the bottle with her hand and took a long, cold pull. Across the road, there was a big empty field of grass, and beyond that, a fringe of pine woods. The trees were every color of green, from a bright yellow-green to a dark color that was almost black. The sky was hot blue.
"I like beer," she said. "I used to sop bread down in the drops our dad left. I like to lick salt out of my hand while I drink. This is the second bottle to myself I've ever had."
"The first swallow was sour, but the rest tastes good." The store man said it was 12 miles from town. They had 4 more miles to go. Harry paid him, and they were out in the hot sun again. Harry was talking loud, and he kept laughing without any reason.
"Gosh, the beer along with this hot sun makes me dizzy, but I sure do feel good," he said. "I can't wait to get in swimming."
There was sand in the road, and they had to throw all their weight on the pedals to keep from bogging. Harry's shirt was stuck to his back with sweat. He still kept talking. The road changed to red clay, and the sand was behind them. There was a slow, colored song in her mind, one Portia's brother used to play on his harp. She pedaled in time to it. Then finally, they reached the place she had been looking for.
"This is it? See that sign that says private? We gotta climb the barbed wire fence and then take that path there, see?"
The woods were very quiet. Slick pine needles covered the ground. Within a few minutes, they had reached the creek. The water was brown and swift, cool. There was no sound except from the water and a breeze singing high up in the pine trees. It was like the deep,
quiet woods made them timid, and they walked softly along the bank beside the creek.
"Don't it look pretty?"
Harry laughed.
"What makes you whisper?
Listen here." He clapped his hand over his mouth and gave a long Indian whoop that echoed back at them.
"Come on, let's jump in the water and cool off."
"Aren't you hungry?"
"Okay, then we'll eat first. We'll eat half the lunch now and half later on when we come out."
She unwrapped the jelly sandwiches. When they were finished, Harry balled the papers neatly and stuffed them into a hollow tree stump. Then he took his shorts and went down the path. She shucked off her clothes behind a bush and struggled into Hazel's bathing suit. The suit was too small and cut her between the legs.
"You ready?"
Harry hollered. She heard a splash in the water, and when she reached the bank, Harry was already swimming.
"Don't dive yet until I find out if there are any stumps or shallow places," he said.
She just looked at his head bobbing in the water. She had never intended to dive anyway. She couldn't even swim. She had been in swimming only a few times in her life, and then she always wore water wings or stayed out of parts that were over her head. But it would be sissy to tell Harry. She was embarrassed. All of a sudden, she told a tale.
"I don't dive anymore. I used to dive, high dive, all the time, but once I busted my head open, so I can't dive anymore."
She thought for a minute.
"It was a double jackknife dive I was doing, and when I came up, there was blood all in the water. But I didn't think anything about it, and I just began doing swimming tricks. These people were hollering at me. Then I found out where all this blood in the water was coming from, and I never have swam good since."
Harry scrambled up the bank.
"Gosh, I never heard about that."
She meant to add on to the tale to make it sound more reasonable, but instead she just looked at Harry. His skin was light brown, and the water made it shining. There were hairs on his chest and legs. In the tight trunks, he seemed very naked. Without his glasses, his face was whiter and more handsome. His eyes were wet and blue. He was looking at her, and it was like suddenly they got embarrassed. "The water's about 10 feet deep, except over on the other bank, and there it's shallow.
Let's just get going. I bet that cold water feels good."
She wasn't scared. She felt the same as if she had got caught at the top of a very high tree, and there was nothing to do but just climb down the best way she could. A dead calm feeling. She edged off the bank and was in ice-cold water. She held to a root until it broke in her hand, and then she began to swim. Once she choked and went under, but she kept going and didn't lose any face. She swam and reached the other side of the bank where she could touch bottom. Then she felt good. She smacked the water with her fists and called out crazy words to make echoes.
"Watch here!"
Harry shimmied up a tall, thin little tree. The trunk was limber, and when he reached the top, it swayed down with him. He dropped into the water.
"Me too! Watch me do it! That's a sapling!"
She was as good a climber as anybody on the block. She copied exactly what he had done and hit the water with a hard smack. She could swim, too. Now she could swim okay. They played follow the leader and ran up and down the bank and jumped in the cold brown water. They hollered and jumped and climbed. They played around for maybe 2 hours. Then they were standing on the bank, and they both looked at each other, and there didn't seem to be anything new to do. Suddenly she said, "Have you ever swam naked?" The woods was very quiet, and for a minute he did not answer. He was cold. His titties had turned hard and purple. His lips were purple. His teeth chattered.
"I don't think so."
This excitement was in her, and she said something she didn't mean to say.
"I would if you would.
I dare you to." Harry slicked back the dark, wet bangs of his hair.
"Okay."
They both took off their bathing suits. Harry had his back to her. He stumbled, and his ears were red. Then they turned toward each other. Maybe it was half an hour they stood there. Maybe not more than a minute. Harry pulled a leaf from a tree and tore it to pieces. "We better get dressed." All through the picnic dinner, neither of them spoke. They spread the dinner on the ground. Harry divided everything in half. There was the hot, sleepy feeling of a summer afternoon. In the deep woods, they could hear no sound except the slow flowing of the water and the songbirds. Harry held his stuffed egg and mashed the yellow with his thumb. What did that make her remember? She heard herself breathe. Then he looked up over her shoulder. "Listen here. I think you're so pretty, Mick. I never did think so before. I don't mean I thought you were very ugly. I just mean that..." She threw a pine cone in the water. "Maybe we better start back if we want to be home before dark." "No," he said. "Let's lie down. Just for a minute." He brought handfuls of pine needles and leaves and gray moss. She sucked her knee and watched him. Her fists were tight, and it was like she was tense all over. "Now we can sleep and be fresh for the trip home." They lay on the soft bed and looked up at the dark green pine clumps against the sky. A bird sang a sad, clear song she had never heard before. One high note, like an oboe, and then it sank down 5 tones and called again. The song was sad as a question without words. "I love that bird," Harry said. "I think it's a vireo. I wish we was at the ocean, on the beach, and watching the ships far out on the water. You went to the beach one summer. Exactly what is it like?" His voice was rough and low. "Well, there are these waves, sometimes blue and sometimes green, and in the bright sun they look glassy. And on the sand, you can pick up these little shells, like the kind we brought back in a cigar box. And over the water are these white gulls. We were at the Gulf of Mexico. These cool bay breezes blew all the time. And there it's never baking hot like it is here. Always snow," Mick said. "That's what I want to see. Cold, white drifts of snow like in pictures. Blizzards. White. Cold snow that keeps falling soft and falls on and on and on through all the winter. Snow, like in Alaska." They both turned at the same time. They were close against each other. She felt him trembling, and her fists were tight enough to crack. "Oh, God," he kept saying over and over. It was like her head was broke off from her body and thrown away. And her eyes looked up, straight into the blinding sun, while she counted something in her mind. And then, this was the way. This was how it was. They pushed the wheels slowly along the road. Harry's head hung down and his shoulders were bent. Their shadows were long and black on the dusty road, for it was late afternoon. "Listen here," he said. "Yeah? We got to understand this. We got to. Do you? Any?" "I don't know. I reckon not." "Listen here. We got to do something. Let's sit down." They dropped the bicycles and sat by a ditch beside the road. They sat far apart from each other. The late sun burned down on their heads, and there were brown, crumbly ant beds all around them. "We got to understand this," Harry said. He cried. He sat very still, and the tears rolled down his white face. She could not think about the thing that made him cry. An ant stung her on the ankle, and she picked it up in her fingers and looked at it very close. "It's this way," he said. "I never had even kissed a girl before." "Me neither. I never kissed any boy out of the family. That's all I used to think about, was to kiss a certain girl. I used to plan about it during school and dream about it at night. And then, once she gave me a date, and I could tell she meant for me to kiss her, and I just looked at her in the dark, and I couldn't. That was all I had thought about, to kiss her. And when the time came, I couldn't." She dug a hole in the ground with her finger and buried the dead ant. "It was all my fault. Adultery is a terrible sin any way you look at it. And you were 2 years younger than me, and just a kid." "No, I wasn't. I wasn't any kid.
But now I wish I was, though. Listen here. If you think we ought to... We can get married. Secretly, or any other way. Mick shook her head. I didn't like that. I never will marry. With any boy. I never will marry either. I know that. And I'm not just saying so. It's true. His face scared her. His nose quivered and his bottom lip was mottled and bloody where he had bitten it. His eyes were bright and wet and scowling. His face was whiter than any face she could remember. She turned her head from him. Things would be better if only he would just quit talking. Her eyes looked slowly around her at the streaked red and white clay of the ditch, at a broken whiskey bottle, at a pine tree across from them with a sign advertising for a man for county sheriff. She wanted to sit quiet for a long time and not think and not say a word. I'm leaving town. I'm a good mechanic and I can get a job some other place. If I stayed home, Mother could read this in my eyes. Tell me, can you look at me and see the difference? Harry watched her face a long time and nodded that he could. Then he said, There's just one more thing. In a month or two, I'll send you my address, and you write and tell me for sure whether you're all right.
How do you mean? She asked slowly.
He explained to her. All you need to write is okay, and then I'll know. They were walking home again, pushing the wheels. Their shadows stretched out giant-sized on the road. Harry was bent over like an old beggar and kept wiping his nose on his sleeve. For a minute, there was a bright golden glow over everything before the sun sank down behind the trees, and their shadows were gone on the road before them. She felt very old, and it was like something was heavy inside her. She was a grown person now, whether she wanted to be or not. They had walked the 16 miles and were in the dark alley at home. She could see the yellow light from their kitchen. Harry's house was dark. His mother had not come home. She worked for a tailor in a shop on a side street, sometimes even on Sunday. When you looked through the window, you could see her bending over the machine in the back or pushing a long needle through the heavy pieces of goods. She never looked up while you watched her, and at night she cooked these orthodox dishes for Harry and her. Listen here, he said. She waited in the dark, but he did not finish. They shook hands with each other, and Harry walked up the dark alley between the houses. When he reached the sidewalk, he turned and looked back over his shoulder. A light shone on his face, and it was white and hard. Then he was gone.
This here is a riddle, George said.
I'll listen. Two Indians was walking on a trail. The one in front was the son of the one behind, but the one behind was not his father. What kin was they? Let's see, his stepfather?
George grinned at Portia with his little square blue teeth.
His uncle, then? You can't guess. It was his mother. The trick is that you don't think about an Indian being a lady.
She stood outside the room and watched them. The doorway framed the kitchen like a picture. Inside, it was homey and clean. Only the light by the sink was turned on, and there were shadows in the room. Bill and Hazel played blackjack at the table with matches for money. Hazel felt the braids of her hair with her plump, pink fingers, while Bill sucked in his cheeks and dealt the cards in a very serious way. At the sink, Portia was drying the dishes with a clean-checked towel. She looked thin, and her skin was golden yellow. Her greased black hair slicked neat. Ralph sat quietly on the floor, and George was trying a little harness on him made out of old Christmas tinsel.
This here is another riddle, Portia. If the hand of a clock points to 2:30...
She went into the room. It was like she had expected them to move back when they saw her and stand around in a circle and look, but they just glanced at her. She sat down at the table and waited.
Here you come traipsing in after everybody done finished supper. Seemed to me like I never will get off from work.
Nobody noticed her. She ate a big plateful of cabbage and salmon and finished off with junket. It was her mama she was thinking about.
The door opened, and her mama came in and told Portia that Miss Brown had said she found a bedbug in her room to get out the gasoline. Quit frowning like that, Mick. You're coming to the age where you ought to fix up and try to look the best you can. And hold on. Don't barge out like that when I speak with you. I mean you to give Ralph a good sponge bath before he goes to bed. Clean his nose and ears. Good. Ralph's soft hair was sticky with oatmeal. She wiped it with a dish rag and rinsed his face and hands at the sink. Bill and Hazel finished their game. Bill's long fingernails scraped on the table as he took up the matches. George carried Ralph off to bed. She and Portia were alone in the kitchen.
Listen, look at me. Do you notice anything different?
Sure I notice, hon.
Portia put on her red hat and changed her shoes.
Well?
Just you take a little grease and rub it on your face. Your nose already done peel very bad. They say grease is the best thing for bad sunburn.
She stood by herself in the dark backyard, breaking off pieces of bark from the oak tree with her fingernails. It was almost worse this way. Maybe she would feel better if they could look at her and tell. If they knew. Her dad called her from the back steps.
Mick? Oh, Mick?
Yes, sir?
The telephone.
George crowded up close and tried to listen in, but she pushed him away. Mrs. Minowitz talked very loud and excited.
My Harry should be home by now. You know where he is?
No, ma'am.
He said you two would ride out on bicycles. Where should he be now? You know where he is?
No, ma'am, Mick said again.
12. Now that the days were hot again, the Sunny Dixie Show was always crowded. The March wind quieted. Trees were thick with their foliage of ochreous green. The sky was a cloudless blue, and the rays of the sun grew stronger. The air was sultry. Jake Blunt hated this weather. He thought dizzily of the long, burning summer months ahead. He did not feel well. Recently, a headache had begun to trouble him constantly. He had gained weight so that his stomach developed a little pouch. He had to leave the top button of his trousers undone. He knew that this was alcoholic fat, but he kept on drinking. Liquor helped the ache in his head. He had only to take one small glass to make it better. Nowadays, one glass was the same to him as a quart. It was not the liquor of the moment that gave him the kick, but the reaction of the first swallow to all the alcohol which had saturated his blood during these last months. A spoonful of beer would help the throbbing in his head, but a quart of whiskey could not make him drunk. He cut out liquor entirely. For several days he drank only water and orange crush. The pain was like a crawling worm in his head. He worked wearily during the long afternoons and evenings. He could not sleep, and it was agony to try to read. The damp, sour stink in his room infuriated him. He lay restless in the bed, and when at last he fell asleep, daylight had come. A dream haunted him. It had first come to him 4 months ago. He would awake with terror, but the strange point was that never could he remember the contents of this dream. Only the feeling remained when his eyes were opened. Each time his fears at awakening were so identical that he did not doubt but what these dreams were the same. He was used to dreams, the grotesque nightmares of drink that led him down into a madman's region of disorder. But always the morning light scattered the effects of these wild dreams, and he forgot them. This blank, stealthy dream was of a different nature. He awoke and could remember nothing, but there was a sense of menace that lingered in him long after. Then he awoke one morning with the old fear, but with a faint remembrance of the darkness behind him. He had been walking among a crowd of people, and in his arms he carried something. That was all he could be sure about. Had he stolen? Had he been trying to save some possession? Was he being hunted by all these people around him? He did not think so. The more he studied this simple dream, the less he could understand. Then for some time afterward, the dream did not return.
He met the writer of signs whose chalked message he had seen the past November. From the first day of their meeting, the old man clung to him like an evil genius. His name was Sims, and he preached on the sidewalks. The winter cold had kept him indoors, but in the spring he was out on the streets all day. His white hair was soft and ragged on his neck, and he carried around with him a woman's big silk pocketbook full of chalk and Jesus ads. His eyes were bright and crazy. Sims tried to convert him.
"Child of adversity, I smell the sinful stink of beer on thy breath, and you smoke cigarettes. If the Lord had wanted us to smoke cigarettes, he would have said so in his book. The mark of Satan is on thy brow. I see it. Repent. Let me show you the light."
Jake rolled up his eyes and made a slow, pious sign in the air. Then he opened his oil-stained hand. "I reveal this only to you," he said in a low stage voice. Sims looked down at the scar in his palm. Jake leaned closer and whispered,
"And there's the other sign, the sign you know, for I was born with them."
Sims backed against the fence. With a womanish gesture, he lifted a lock of silver hair from his forehead and smoothed it back on his head. Nervously, his tongue licked the corners of his mouth. Jake laughed.
"Blasphemer!"
Sims screamed.
"God will get you, you and all your crew. God remembers the scoffers. He watches after me. God watches everybody, but he watches me the most, like he did Moses. God tells me things in the night. God will get you."
He took Sims down to a corner store for Coca-Colas and peanut butter crackers. Sims began to work on him again. When he left for the show, Sims ran along behind him.
"Come to this corner tonight at 7 o'clock. Jesus has a message just for you."
The first days of April were windy and warm. White clouds trailed across the blue sky. In the wind, there was the smell of the river and also the fresher smell of fields beyond the town. The show was crowded every day from 4 p.m. until midnight. The crowd was a tough one. With the new spring, he felt an undertone of trouble. One night, he was working on the machinery of the swings when suddenly he was roused from thought by the sounds of angry voices. Quickly, he pushed through the crowd until he saw a white girl fighting with a colored girl by the ticket booth of the Flying Jinny. He wrenched them apart, but still they struggled to get at each other. The crowd took sides, and there was a bedlam of noise. The white girl was a hunchback. She held something tight in her hand.
"I seen you," the colored girl yelled. "I'll go beat that hunch off your back, too. Hush your mouth, you black nigger. Low down factor and tag, I done pay my money and I get a ride. White man, you make her give me back my ticket. Black nigger slut."
Jake looked from one to the other. The crowd pressed close. There were mumbled opinions on every side.
"I seen Laura drop her ticket. I watched this here white lady pick it up. That the truth," a colored boy said.
"No nigger gonna put her hands on no white girl, white. You quit that pushing me. I'm ready to hit back even if your skin do be white."
Roughly, Jake pushed into the thick of the crowd.
"All right," he yelled. "Move on. Break it up. Every damn one of you."
There was something about the size of his fists that made the people drift sullenly away. Jake turned back to the two girls.
"This here the way it is," said the colored girl. "I bet I'm one of the few peoples here who done save over 50 cents till Friday night. I done earned double this week. I done pay a good nickel for that ticket she holdin', and now I means to ride."
Jake settled the trouble quickly. He let the hunchback keep the disputed ticket and issued another one to the colored girl. For the rest of that evening, there were no more quarrels. But Jake moved alertly through the crowd. He was troubled and uneasy. In addition to himself, there were 5 other employees at the show. 2 men to operate the swings and take tickets, and 3 girls to manage the booths. This did not count Patterson. The show owner spent most of his time playing cards with himself in his trailer. His eyes were dull, with the pupils shrunken,
and the skin of his neck hung in yellow, pulpy folds. During the past few months, Jake had had two raises in pay. At midnight, it was his job to report to Patterson and hand over the takings of the evening. Sometimes Patterson did not notice him until he had been in the trailer for several minutes. He would be staring at the cards, sunk in a stupor. The air of the trailer was heavy with the stinks of food and reefers. Patterson held his hand over his stomach as though protecting it from something. He always checked over the accounts very thoroughly. Jake and the two operators had a squabble. These men were both former doffers at one of the mills. At first he had tried to talk to them and help them to see the truth. Once he invited them to a pool room for a drink, but they were so dumb he couldn't help them. Soon after this, he overheard the conversation between them that caused the trouble. It was an early Sunday morning, almost 2 o'clock, and he had been checking the accounts with Patterson. When he stepped out of the trailer, the ground seemed empty. The moon was bright. He was thinking of Singer and the free day ahead. Then as he passed by the swings, he heard someone speak his name. The two operators had finished work and were smoking together. Jake listened. "If there's anything I hate worse than a nigger, it's a red. He tickles me. I don't pay him no mind. The way he struts around, I never seen such a sawed-off runt. How tall is he, you reckon?" "Around 5 foot. But he thinks he got to tell everybody so much, he ought to be in jail, that's where. The red Bolshevik. He just tickles me. I can't look at him without laughing. He needn't act biggity with me." Jake watched them follow the path toward Weaver's Lane. His first thought was to rush out and confront them, but a certain shrinking held him back. For several days, he fumed in silence. Then one night after work, he followed the two men for several blocks, and as they turned a corner, he cut in front of them.
"I heard you," he said breathlessly. "It so happened I heard every word you said last Saturday night. Sure, I'm a red. At least I reckon I am. But what are you?"
They stood beneath a street light. The two men stepped back from him. The neighborhood was deserted.
"You pasty-faced, shrunk-gutted, ricket-ridden little rats. I could reach out and choke your stringy necks. One to each hand. Runt or no, I could lay you on this sidewalk where they'd have to scrape you up with shovels."
The two men looked at each other, cowed, and tried to walk on, but Jake would not let them pass. He kept step with them, walking backward, a furious sneer on his face.
"All I got to say is this. In the future, I suggest you come to me whenever you feel the need to make remarks about my height, weight, accent, demeanor, or ideology. And that last is not what I take a leak with, either, in case you don't know. We will discuss it together."
Afterward, Jake treated the two men with angry contempt. Behind his back, they jeered at him. One afternoon, he found that the engine of the swings had been deliberately damaged, and he had to work 3 hours overtime to fix it. Always he felt someone was laughing at him. Each time he heard the girls talking together, he drew himself up straight and laughed carelessly aloud to himself, as though thinking of some private joke. The warm southwest winds from the Gulf of Mexico were heavy with the smells of spring. The days grew longer, and the sun was bright. The lazy warmth depressed him. He began to drink again. As soon as work was done, he went home and lay down on his bed. Sometimes he stayed there, fully clothed and inert, for 12 or 13 hours. The restlessness that had caused him to sob and bite his nails only a few months before seemed to have gone. And yet, beneath his inertia, Jake felt the old tension. Of all the places he had been, this was the loneliest town of all, or it would be without Singer. Only he and Singer understood the truth. He knew and could not get the don't-knows to see. It was like trying to fight darkness or heat or a stink in the air. He stared morosely out of his window. A stunted, smoke-blackened tree at the corner had put out new leaves of a bilious green. The sky was always a deep, hard blue. The mosquitoes from a fetid stream that ran through this part of the town buzzed in the room.
He caught the itch. He mixed some sulfur and hog fat and greased his body every morning. He clawed himself raw, and it seemed that the itching would never be soothed. One night, he broke loose. He had been sitting alone for many hours. He had mixed gin and whiskey and was very drunk. It was almost morning. He leaned out of the window and looked at the dark, silent street. He thought of all the people around him, sleeping, the don't-knows. Suddenly, he bawled out in a loud voice,
"This is the truth! You bastards don't know anything! You don't know! You don't know!"
The street awoke angrily. Lamps were lighted and sleepy curses were called to him. The men who lived in the house rattled furiously on his door. The girls from a cat house across the street stuck their heads out of the windows.
"You dumb, 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 dumb bastards! You dumb, 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 dumb! Shut up! Shut up!"
The fellows in the hall were pushing against the door.
"You drunk bull! You'll be a sight dumber when we get through with you." "How many out there?"
Jake roared. He banged an empty bottle on the windowsill.
"Come on, everybody. Come one, come all. I'll settle you three at a time."
"That's right, honey,"
a whore called. The door was giving way. Jake jumped from the window and ran through a side alley.
"Hey-haw! Hee-haw!"
he yelled drunkenly. He was barefooted and shirtless. An hour later, he stumbled into Singer's room. He sprawled on the floor and laughed himself to sleep. On an April morning, he found the body of a man who had been murdered, a young Negro. Jake found him in a ditch about 30 yards from the showgrounds. The Negro's throat had been slashed, so the head was rolled back at a crazy angle. The sun shone hot on his open, glassy eyes, and flies hovered over the dried blood that covered his chest. The dead man held a red and yellow cane with a tassel, like the one sold at the hamburger booth at the show. Jake stared gloomily down at the body for some time. Then he called the police. No clues were found. 2 days later, the family of the dead man claimed his body at the morgue. At the Sunny Dixie, there were frequent fights and quarrels. Sometimes two friends would come to the show, arm in arm, laughing and drinking, and before they left, they would be struggling together in a panting rage. Jake was always alert. Beneath the gaudy gaiety of the show, the bright lights and the lazy laughter, he felt something sullen and dangerous. Through these dazed, disjointed weeks, Sims nagged his footsteps constantly. The old man liked to come with a soapbox and a Bible and take a stand in the middle of the crowd to preach. He talked of the second coming of Christ. He said that the day of judgment would be October 2nd, 1951. He would point out certain drunks and scream at them in his raw, worn voice. Excitement made his mouth fill with water so that his words had a wet, gurgling sound. Once he had slipped in and set up his stand, no arguments could make him budge. He made Jake a present of a Gideon Bible and told him to pray on his knees for 1 hour each night and to hurl away every glass of beer or cigarette that was offered him. They quarreled over walls and fences. Jake had begun to carry chalk in his pockets also. He wrote brief sentences. He tried to word them so that a passerby would stop and ponder over the meaning, so that a man would wonder, so that a man would think. Also, he wrote short pamphlets and distributed them in the streets. If it had not been for Singer, Jake knew that he would have left the town. Only on Sunday, when he was with his friend, did he feel at peace. Sometimes they would go for a walk together or play chess, but more often they spent the day quietly in Singer's room. If he wished to talk, Singer was always attentive. If he sat morosely through the day, the mute understood his feelings and was not surprised. It seemed to him that only Singer could help him now. Then, one Sunday, when he climbed the stairs, he saw that Singer's door was open. The room was empty. He sat alone for more than 2 hours,
At last he heard Singer's footsteps on the stairs.
Well, I was wondering about you. Where you been?
Singer smiled. He brushed off his hat with a handkerchief and put it away. Then deliberately, he took his silver pencil from his pocket and leaned over the mantelpiece to write a note.
What you mean?
Jake asked when he read what the mute had written.
Whose legs are cut off?
Singer took back the note and wrote a few additional sentences.
Huh, Jake said. That don't surprise me.
He brooded over the piece of paper and then crumpled it in his hand. The listlessness of the past month was gone, and he was tense and uneasy.
Huh, he said again.
Singer put on a pot of coffee and got out his chessboard. Jake tore the note to pieces and rolled the fragments between his sweating palms.
But something can be done about this,
he said after a while.
You know it?
Singer nodded uncertainly.
I want to see the boy and hear the whole story. When can you take me around there?
Singer deliberated. Then he wrote on a pad of paper, tonight. Jake held his hand to his mouth and began to walk restlessly around the room.
We can do something.
13. Jake and Singer waited on the front porch. When they pushed the doorbell, there was no sound of a ring in the darkened house. Jake knocked impatiently and pressed his nose against the screen door. Beside him, Singer stood wooden and smiling, with two spots of color on his cheeks, for they had drunk a bottle of gin together. The evening was quiet and dark. Jake watched a yellow light shaft softly through the hall, and Portia opened the door for them.
I certainly trust you not been waiting long. So many folks been coming that us thought it wise to untatch the bell. You gentlemen's just let me take your hats. Father been mighty sick.
Jake tiptoed heavily behind Singer down the bare, narrow hall. At the threshold of the kitchen, he stopped short. The room was crowded and hot. A fire burned in the small wood stove, and the windows were closed tight. Smoke mingled with a certain negro smell. The glow from the stove was the only light in the room. The dark voices he had heard back in the hall were silent.
These here are two white gentlemen's come to inquire about Father, Portia said. I think maybe he'd be able to see you, but I better go on in first and prepare him.
Jake fingered his thick lower lip. On the end of his nose, there was a latticed impression from the front screen door.
Now that's not it, he said. I come to talk with your brother.
The Negroes in the room were standing. Singer motioned to them to be seated again. Two grizzled old men sat down on a bench by the stove. A loose-limbed mulatto lounged against the window. On a camp cot in a corner was a boy without legs, whose trousers were folded and pinned beneath his stumpy thighs.
A good evening, Jake said awkwardly. Your name Copeland?
The boy put his hands over the stumps of his legs and shrank back close to the wall.
My name Willie.
Honey, don't you worry none, said Portia. This here is Mr. Singer that you heard Father speak about. And this other white gentleman is Mr. Blunt, and he a very close friend of Mr. Singer. They just kindly come to inquire about us and our trouble.
She turned to Jake and motioned to the three other people in the room.
This other boy leaning on the window is my brother, too, named Buddy. And these here over by the stove is two dear friends of my father, named Mr. Marshall Nichols and Mr. John Roberts. I think it a good idea to understand who all is in a room with you.
Well, thanks, Jake said.
He turned to Willie again.
I just want you to tell me about it so I can get it straight in my mind.
This the way it is, Willie said. I feel like my feet's are still hurting. I got this here terrible misery down in my toes. Yet the hurt in my feet's is down where my feet should be if they were still on my legs, and not where my feet's is now. It's a hard thing to understand. My feet's hurt me so bad all the time, and I don't know where they is. They never given them back to me. They's somewhere more than 100 miles from here.
I mean about how it all happened, Jake said.
Uneasily, Willie looked up at his sister.
I don't remember very good.
Course you remember, honey. You done already told us over and over.
Well, the boy's voice was timid and sullen. Us were all out on the road, and this here buster say something to the guard, the white man taking a stick to him. Then this other boy, he tries to run off, and I follow him. It all come about so quick I don't remember good just how it were. Then they taken us back to the camp, and I know the rest, Jake said. But give me the names and addresses of the other two boys, and tell me the names of the guards.
Listen here, white man. It seemed to me like you mean to get me into trouble.
Trouble? Jake said rudely. What in the name of Christ do you think you're in now?
Let's just quiet down, Portia said nervously. This here the way it is, Mr. Blunt. They done let Willie off at the camp before his time was served. But they done also impressed it on him not to... I believe you understand what us means. Naturally, Willie, he's scared. Naturally, us means to be careful. Because that's the best thing us can do. We already got enough trouble as is.
What happened to the guards?
Them white men were fired. That what they told me.
And where are your friends now?
What friends?
Well, the other two boys.
They're not my friends, Willie said. Us all has had a big falling out.
How do you mean?
Portia pulled her earrings so that the lobes of her ears stretched like rubber.
This here what Willie means. You see, during them 3 days when they hurt so bad they commenced to quarrel, Willie don't ever want to see any of them again. That one thing Father and Willie done argued about already. This here Buster?
Buster got a wooden leg, said the boy by the window. I seen him on the street today.
This here Buster don't have no folks, and it were Father's idea to have him move on in with us. Father want to round up all the boys together. How he reckons us can feed them, I sure don't know.
That ain't a good idea. And besides, us was never very good friends anyway.
Willie felt the stumps of his legs with his dark, strong hands.
I just wish I knowed where my feets are. That the main thing worries me. The doctor never given them back to me. I sure do wish I knowed where they are.
Jake looked around him with dazed, gin-clouded eyes. Everything seemed unclear and strange. The heat in the kitchen dizzied him so that the voices echoed in his ears. The smoke choked him. The light hanging from the ceiling was turned on, but as the bulb was wrapped in newspaper to dim its strength, most of the light came from between the chinks of the hot stove. There was a red glow on all the dark faces around him. He felt uneasy and alone. Singer had left the room to visit Portia's father. Jake wanted him to come back so that they could leave. He walked awkwardly across the floor and sat down on the bench between Marshall Nichols and John Roberts.
"Where is Portia's father?" he asked.
"Dr. Copeland is in the front room, sir," said Roberts.
"Is he a doctor?"
"Yes, sir. He is a medical doctor."
There was a scuffle on the steps outside, and the back door opened. A warm, fresh breeze lightened the heavy air. First, a tall boy dressed in a linen suit and gilded shoes entered the room with a sack in his arms. Behind him came a young boy of about 17.
"Hey, hi, boy. Hey there, Lancy," Willie said. "What you all brought me?"
Hi, boy bowed elaborately to Jake and placed on the table 2 fruit jars of wine. Lancy put beside them a plate covered with a fresh white napkin.
"This here wine is a present from the society," Howboy said. "And Lance's mother sent some peach puffs." "How is the doctor, Miss Portia?" Lancy asked.
"Honey, he been mighty sick these days. What worries me is he's so strong. It's a bad sign when a person sick as he has suddenly come to be so strong."
Portia turned to Jake.
"Don't you think it a bad sign, Mr. Blunt?"
Jake stared at her dazedly.
"I don't know."
Lancy glanced sullenly at Jake and pulled down the cuffs of his outgrown shirt.
"Give the doctor my family's regards." "I certainly do appreciate this," Portia said.
Father was speaking of you just the other day. He has a book he wants to give you. Wait just 1 minute while I get it and wrench out this plate to return to your mother. This was certainly a kind of thing for her to do. Marshal Nichols leaned toward Jake and seemed about to speak to him. The old man wore a pair of pinstriped trousers and a morning coat with a flower in the buttonhole. He cleared his throat and said, "Pardon me, sir, but unavoidably we overheard a part of your conversation with William regarding the trouble he is now in. Inevitably, we have considered what is the best course to take."
"You one of his relatives, or the preacher in his church?"
"No, I am a pharmacist, and John Roberts on your left is employed in the postal department of the government."
"A postman," repeated John Roberts.
"With your permission..." Marshal Nichols took a yellow silk handkerchief from his pocket and gingerly blew his nose. "Naturally, we have discussed this matter extensively, and without doubt, as members of the colored race here in this free country of America, we are anxious to do our part toward extending amicable relationships."
"We wish always to do the right thing," said John Roberts, "and it behooves us to strive with care and not endanger this amicable relationship already established. Then, by gradual means, a better condition will come about."
Jake turned from one to the other.
"I don't seem to follow you."
The heat was suffocating him. He wanted to get out. A film seemed to have settled over his eyeballs so that all the faces around him were blurred. Across the room, Willie was playing his harp. Buddy and Highboy were listening. The music was dark and sad. When the song was finished, Willie polished his harp on the front of his shirt.
"I'm so hungry and thirsty, the slobber in my mouth done wet out the tune. I certainly will be glad to taste some of that boogie-woogie. To have something good to drink's the only thing made me forget this misery. If I just knowed where my feet's are now, and could drink a glass of gin every night, I wouldn't mind so much."
"Don't fret, hon. You're gonna have something," Portia said.
"Mr. Blunt, would you care to take a peach puff and a glass of wine?"
"Thanks," Jake said. "That would be good."
Quickly, Portia laid a cloth on the table and set down one plate and a fork. She poured a large tumblerful of the wine.
"You just make yourself comfortable here, and if you don't mind, I'm going to serve the others."
The fruit jars were passed from mouth to mouth. Before Highboy passed a jar to Willie, he borrowed Portia's lipstick and drew a red line to set the boundary of the drink. There were gurgling noises and laughter. Jake finished his puff and carried his glass back with him to his place between the two old men. The homemade wine was rich and strong as brandy. Willie started a low, dolorous tune on his harp. Portia snapped her fingers and shuffled around the room. Jake turned to Marshal Nichols.
"You say Portia's father is a doctor?"
"Yes, sir. Yes, indeed. A skilled doctor."
"What's the matter with him?"
The two Negroes glanced warily at each other.
"He were in an accident," said John Roberts.
"What kind of accident?"
"A bad one. A deplorable one."
Marshal Nichols folded and unfolded his silk handkerchief.
"As we were remarking a while ago, it is important not to impair these amicable relations, but to promote them in all ways earnestly possible. We members of the colored race must strive in all ways to uplift our citizens. The doctor in yonder has strived in every way, but sometimes it has seemed to me like he has not recognized fully enough certain elements of the different races in the situation."
Impatiently, Jake gulped down the last swallows of his wine.
"Christ's sake, man, speak out plain, because I can't understand a thing you say."
Marshal Nichols and John Roberts exchanged a hurt look. Across the room, Willie still sat playing music. His lips crawled over the square holes of the harmonica like fat, puckered caterpillars. His shoulders were broad and strong.
The stumps of his thighs jerked in time to the music. Highboy danced while Buddy and Portia clapped out the rhythm. Jake stood up, and once on his feet, he realized that he was drunk. He staggered and then glanced vindictively around him, but no one seemed to have noticed.
"Where's Singer?"
he asked Portia thickly.
The music stopped.
"Well, Mr. Blunt, I thought you knowed he was gone. While you was sitting at the table with your peach puff, he come to the doorway and held out his watch to show it were time for him to go. You looked straight at him and shaking your head. I thought you knowed that."
"Well, maybe I was thinking about something else."
He turned to Willie and said angrily to him,
"I never did even get to tell you what I come here for. I didn't come to ask you to do anything. All I wanted was this. You and the other boys were to testify what happened, and I was to explain why. Why is the only important thing, not what. I would have pushed you all around in the wagon, and you would have had told your story, and afterward, I would have explained why. And maybe it might have meant something. Maybe it..."
He felt they were laughing at him. Confusion caused him to forget what he had meant to say. The room was full of dark, strange faces, and the air was too thick to breathe. He saw a door and staggered across to it. He was in a dark closet smelling of medicine. Then his hand was turning another doorknob. He stood on the threshold of a small white room furnished only with an iron bed, a cabinet, and two chairs. On the bed lay the terrible Negro he had met on the stairs at Singer's house. His face was very black against the white, stiff pillows. The dark eyes were hot with hatred, but the heavy, bluish lips were composed. His face was motionless as a black mask, except for the slow, wide flutters of his nostrils with each breath.
"Get out,"
the Negro said.
"Wait," Jake said helplessly. "Why do you say that?" "This is my house."
Jake could not draw his eyes away from the Negro's terrible face.
"But why?" "You are a white man, and a stranger."
Jake did not leave. He walked with cumbersome caution to one of the straight white chairs and seated himself. The Negro moved his hands on the counterpane. His black eyes glittered with fever. Jake watched him. They waited. In the room, there was a feeling tense as conspiracy or as the deadly quiet before an explosion. It was long past midnight. The warm, dark air of the spring morning swirled the blue layers of smoke in the room. On the floor were crumpled balls of paper and a half-empty bottle of gin. Scattered ashes were gray on the counterpane. Dr. Copeland pressed his head tensely into the pillow. He had removed his dressing gown, and the sleeves of his white cotton nightshirt were rolled to the elbow. Jake leaned forward in his chair. His tie was loosened, and the collar of his shirt had wilted with sweat. Through the hours, there had grown between them a long, exhausting dialogue, and now a pause had come.
"So the time is ready for..."
Jake began, but Dr. Copeland interrupted him.
"Now it is perhaps necessary that we..." he murmured huskily.
They halted. Each looked into the eyes of the other and waited.
"I beg your pardon," Dr. Copeland said. "Sorry," said Jake. "Go on." "No, you continue." "Well," Jake said, "I won't say what I started to say. Instead, we'll have one last word about the South, the strangled South, the wasted South, the slavish South, and the Negro people."
To steady himself, Jake swallowed a long, burning draft from the bottle on the floor beside him. Then deliberately he walked to the cabinet and picked up a small, cheap globe of the world that served as a paperweight. Slowly he turned the sphere in his hands.
"All I can say is this. The world is full of meanness and evil. 3/4 of this globe is in a state of war or oppression. The liars and fiends are united, and the men who know are isolated and without defense. But, if you was to ask me to point out the most uncivilized area on the face of this globe, I would point here.
Watch sharp, said Dr. Copeland. You're out in the ocean.
Jake turned the globe again and pressed his blunt, grimy thumb on a carefully selected spot.
Here, these 13 states. I know what I'm talking about. I read books and I go around. I've been in every damn one of these 13 states. I've worked in every one, and the reason I think like I do is this. We live in the richest country in the world. There's plenty and to spare for no man, woman, or child to be in want. And in addition to this, our country was founded on what should have been a great true principle, the freedom, equality, and rights of each individual. Oh, and what has come of that start? There are corporations worth billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of people who can't get to eat. And here in these 13 states, the exploitation of human beings is so that it's a thing you gotta take in with your own eyes. In my life, I've seen things that would make a man go crazy. At least one-third of all Southerners live and die no better off than the lowest peasant in any European fascist state. The average wage of a worker on a tenant farm is only $73 per year. And mind you, that's the average. The wages of sharecroppers run from $35 to $90 per person. And $35 a year means just about 10 cents for a full day's work. Everywhere there's pellagra and hookworm and anemia and just plain pure starvation. But
Jake rubbed his lips with the knuckles of his dirty fist. Sweat stood out on his forehead.
But, he repeated, those are only the evils you can see and touch. The other things are worse. I'm talking about the way that the truth has been hidden from the people. The things they have been told so they can't see the truth. The poisonous lies so they aren't allowed to know.
And the Negro, said Dr. Copeland. To understand what is happening to us, you have to...
Jake interrupted him savagely.
Who owns the South? Corporations in the North own 3/4 of all the South. They say the old cow grazes all over in the South, the West, the North, and the East. But she's milked in just one place. Her old teats swing over just one spot when she's full. She grazes everywhere and is milked in New York. Take our cotton mills. Our pulp mills, our harness factories, our mattress factories. The North owns them. And what happens?
Jake's mustache quivered angrily.
Here's an example. Locale, a mill village according to the great paternal system of American industry. Absentee ownership. In the village is one huge brick mill and maybe 400 or 500 shanties. The houses aren't fit for human beings to live in. Moreover, the houses were built to be nothing but slums in the first place. These shanties are nothing but 2 or maybe 3 rooms and a privy, built with far less forethought than the barns to house cattle. Built with far less attention to needs than sties for pigs. For under this system, pigs are valuable and men are not. You can't make pork chops and sausage out of a skinny little mill kids. You can't sell but half the people these days. But a pig?
Hold on, said Dr. Copeland. You are getting off on a tangent. And besides, you are giving no attention to the very separate question of the Negro. I cannot get a word in edgeways. We've been over all this before. But it is impossible to see the full situation without including us Negroes.
Back to our mill village, Jake said. A young lint head begins working at the fine wage of $8 or $10 a week at such times as he can get himself employed. He marries. After the first child, the woman must work in the mill also. Their combined wages come to, say, $18 a week when they both got work. Huh. They pay a fourth of this for the shack the mill provides them. They buy food and clothes at a company-owned or dominated store. The store overcharges on every item. With three or four young'uns, they are held down the same as if they had on chains. That is a whole principle of serfdom. Yet, here in America, we call ourselves free. And the funny thing is that this has been drilled into the heads of sharecroppers and lint heads and all the rest so hard that they really believe it. But it's taken a hell of a lot of lies to keep them from knowing. There is only one way out, said Dr. Copeland. Two ways, and only two ways. Once there was a time when this country was expanding, every man thought he had a chance. But that period is gone, and gone for good. Less than 100 corporations have swallowed all but a few leavings. These industries have already sucked the blood and softened the bones of the people. The old days of expansion are gone. The whole system of capitalistic democracy is rotten and corrupt. There remain only two roads ahead. One, fascism. Two, reform of the most revolutionary and permanent kind. And the Negro? Do not forget the Negro. So far as I and my people are concerned, the South is fascist now, and always has been. Yeah. The Nazis robbed the Jews of their legal, economic, and cultural life. Here the Negro has always been deprived of these. And if wholesale and dramatic robbery of money and goods has not taken place here as in Germany, it is simply because the Negro has never been allowed to accrue wealth in the first place. That's the system, Jake said. The Jew and the Negro, said Dr. Copeland bitterly. The history of my people will be commensurate with the interminable history of the Jew, only bloodier and more violent, like a certain species of seagull. If you capture one of the birds and tie a red string of twine around his leg, the rest of the flock will peck him to death.
Dr. Copeland took off his spectacles and rebound a wire around a broken hinge. Then he polished the lenses on his nightshirt. His hand shook with agitation.
Mr. Singer is a Jew. No, you're wrong there. But I am positive that he is. The name Singer. I recognized his race the first time I saw him. From his eyes. Besides, he told me so. Why, he couldn't have, Jake insisted. He's pure Anglo-Saxon, if I ever saw it. Irish and Anglo-Saxon. But I'm certain. Absolutely.
Very well, said Dr. Copeland. We will not quarrel.